Good morning and welcome back to the First Cup of Joe show brought to you by Level Up. I'm your host Christian here with my dad Jeff and my brother Eli. Today on the show, we are going to highlight three leaders from the past, digging into the stories of their lives. Stick around to hear who those three leaders are. Let's get into the show. I'm Christian Custer and you're listening to a freshly brewed episode of the First Cup of Joe show, where we explore leadership principles that are tested and proven, uncover the obvious but not practiced, and use our experiences to lay the foundation for you to be an effective leader. Presented by Level Up Courses, a leadership development company with over 40 years of experience that's built to rid the world of toxic leaders. Dad, Eli, the first of our three leaders is the leader that I'm bringing to the table, whose name is Michael Jordan. I know you both know who he is, but listeners, if you haven't heard who that is, Michael Jordan is arguably the greatest basketball player to ever play the game, both statistically, championship-wise, but also I'd say from a leadership perspective. And two words that I'd give to him are excellence and tenacity. I'm going to give a brief historical timeline here for Michael Jordan. He was born in 1963 in New York. He earned a basketball scholarship to go play for the University of North Carolina in 1981. In 1983, he was drafted by the Chicago Bulls. In 1985, he won Rookie of the Year. Then over the course of Michael Jordan's NBA career, he won six championships with the Chicago Bulls. Throughout his career, he had many moments where his leadership showed on the court, from a game where he was scored a winning bucket while he was extremely sick, to times where he would pick up his teammates and fly to a different state to make sure that they came back in order to play in the game because he needed his teammate there to help him win. And as we're going to talk about these three leaders here today, there are certainly times where, you know, he wasn't perfect. He did things that you kind of shake your head and say, that's not a very good look. But there's many more times where what he did to lift people up around him, to make everybody else better, to push himself as far as excellence goes in his own game, shows why he's the greatest basketball player of all time.
Yeah, Christian, I think that you set that up well. And Jordan is a very successful person from a basketball standpoint. I think it's interesting what you said about the picking other teammates up from the airport, or not from the airport, picking other teammates up from other states. I've never heard this before. He is one of the greatest basketball players. Curious to know more about that aspect. What's more of the story there, and how he, I guess, lead his team and bring him along? Because there's a lot of guys who just try and do it themselves.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is he demanded excellence of himself.
Right.
So you hear the stories of how many free throws he would shoot, and just the time that he would put in, and what he would push himself to do, you know, on the basketball court when they were in practice, and they were doing sprints for conditioning. He wanted to be the first one.
Right.
He wanted to beat everybody else on his own team in practice.
Right. Yeah, all the time and everything.
Absolutely everything. He just wanted to be the best, and it didn't even matter. You hear a lot of stories about his gambling and how he'd go and golf, and he was so competitive. I'm sure he still does this today. He just wants to be the best at whatever he's doing. And his desire to be the best it goes beyond what his physical body, when your body tells you to stop, your mind tells you to keep going. He's one of those guys that has the mind that says, I'm going to keep going.
Yeah, just ultra, ultra competitive. You know, you, Christian, like you laid out there, not only in basketball, but in everything. I've read stories where on the plane going back and forth to games, he and the teammates would play cards on the plane, and he was just a relentless competitor playing cards. It was it was everything about him was ultra competitive, which put six rings on his fingers. You know, so often about leaders, the thing that we bring up to say that makes them great is also the thing that also can be their downfall. Because you hear a lot of stories about his competitiveness really crossing the line to where it was almost abusive to the people around him.
Certainly, you know, family issues outside of the basketball court, but just soured relationships with guys that he used to play with. But I want to get back to the story that Eli was asking about. So he played with Dennis Rodman. And if you know anything about Dennis Rodman, he was a wild card, to say the least. He just was an excellent basketball player. He also was tenacious, and he was ferocious. He just wanted to go play defense, get the rebounds. He was diving all over. But he was also wild outside of basketball. And he would go to Las Vegas and he'd go to places and just he'd go and do whatever he was doing at night. And they had a game and Dennis wasn't back. And so Michael Jordan flew to go get him, brought him back for their game. What I think is interesting, there's a docu-series that was put out called The Last Dance on Michael Jordan. And in that series, it explained kind of what Phil Jackson, who was the coach of the Bulls at the time, what his philosophy and how him and Michael Jordan in a way sort of worked together to kind of let Dennis Rodman do what he needed to do outside of basketball. And what their thought was is that if we let him go do those things, he's going to be more productive in basketball. And if we try to keep him in Chicago, if we try to sort of rein him in on his craziness outside, he's not going to be as effective doing what we need him to do, which I think a lot of people would look at that and say, well, that's not good leadership because you're letting one guy go do his thing and he's not part of the team and he's, you know, not doing things he should be doing or shouldn't be doing. But you had a couple guys in Michael Jordan and in Phil Jackson that understood that for Dennis to be successful on the basketball court, he needed to be able to go do these other things. And the ability to understand that about somebody, I think is fascinating.
I've never thought about that before, Christian. You wonder how it affected the rest of the team. What the other guys thought of that. Maybe they were totally bought into it and they wanted to win the ring as bad as Phil Jackson and Michael Jordan. So they were okay with it, you know, but maybe you got some guy on the team who's, you know, really straight, running the straight and narrow and really not, you know, doing the complete opposite. You know, what does a guy like that think? And as a leader, as Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson, they almost have to make a decision of like, well, we might ostracize other people if we allow one guy to run around and do whatever he wants.
I don't know. Yeah, I agree with you. I think, and I'm sure that did happen. I think there was something about Michael Jordan that he was so contagious that people wanted to be around him when he was playing.
Yeah, and I think you look at the intensity of the focus and the clarity in what they were trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. You know, at least in the sports world, I think it's sometimes easier than in business, but there was very clear purpose on what they were doing. They wanted to win the championship. And you know, so you start getting at people, you know, understanding roles like you talked about, Christian. And then there's this risk that you guys are talking about that people resent other teammates have this resentment looking and saying, well, you know, how come that guy gets to go do that? I don't get to do that. But it seems they were able to transcend that stuff or at least suppress that stuff because everybody was bought into the ultimate goal.
Yeah. And they succeeded a lot.
And they succeeded. So if you were on that team and you was like, well, I'm starting to feel kind of resentful that this guy gets to do something different that I probably don't get to do, you know, you're just like, okay, I don't care about that because I know I'm going to win the championship with these guys.
Right. I mean, the time Dennis Rodman got to be on the team, they had probably already won 3 championships. Is that right?
Yeah.
So they had already proven them. Jordan had already proven that he was going to succeed. And so that probably helps lead into this. I mean, as a new leader, he probably wouldn't have gotten away with that.
I just translate it back to business. I think it's just it'd be a way more difficult thing when you start treating someone different than everyone else. There's an awful lot of risk that everything falls apart on you. Mm. And I think it's probably because you don't have that same clarity of goal.
Right.
It's just so hard. It's so hard. Yeah, I know you want to make a profit in business and sales and whatever, but it's just a different mentality than what they had with the Bulls.
Mm.
Sports, too, is really short term. I mean, you're really talking about a year, and even within that, you're talking about a 9-month season.
Right.
That you have to be excellent. Not an, you know, and the goal, of course, is to continue year after year. If you look at any sport, teams, as soon as the day of the season's over, even during the season, players are switching from team to team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And stuff changes all the time. And that's, of course, you know, a little different in business where you're, you know, the longevity is just a view of longevity is much different.
When you say that, a 9-month period, you know, it makes me wonder how loyal are these guys, you know? Like, are they loyal to a leader? Are they loyal to the Bulls organization? Or are they loyal to a mission to win the championship?
Yeah, I think, you know, you look back, I think the organization was probably not that great. I think the people running the organization, I don't think a lot of the players liked the people running the organization back then. And I think it was just purely this, we have something special because we really can create this dynasty that, like you said, Christian, is just so rare to see in sports, you know. So, you know, somebody will win the championship here and there, but those teams that are truly the dynasty are so rare. And so you have this opportunity to be a part of something very special. And it gets people to be able to set aside some of the things that in a normal situation would probably cause things to fall apart. Because they knew they were part of that very special thing, they could set those things aside because they wanted that.
Jordan's leadership reminds me of how we talk about meticulous hiring. And I know he wasn't actually hiring people probably on the front page, but him being so hard on his teammates is similar to how a good leader should be to expect that excellence like you talked about, Christian. And good people will come and stay because of something special. And when we talk about the hiring process, if you are meticulous and you only hire excellent people, I think you're going to have a lot of excellent people start to apply and come and try and work for you.
Definitely during the application process, the interview process, but I think the principle goes into your daily work too.
Sure.
I used to work for a guy and he wasn't a basketball player, but he demanded excellence on the job site. And we were in construction. He demanded that things got built the right way the first time. We didn't screw up. I mean, that was pretty basic. It was go do what I'm telling you to do and do it right. But yep. he had this, and I don't know if this is something you can teach or not, but he had this similar thing about him, like Michael Jordan, where it was like, man, I want to do I want to do as good as I can for this guy. Cause I just really have a desire to accomplish what it's almost like they have a belief in you that you can do it. But just want to live up to the expectations that person has for the team, for me. And when you, if you've ever worked for a person like that, I think you would know.
Yeah.
And it's a special person to be around. I was going back and forth between Michael Jordan and Tom Brady. you know, there's things we don't have time. We need to move on, but there's certainly things that in his personal life that you can nitpick, and, you know, in his professional career, I'm sure that you can nitpick on why he wasn't the, you know, always a good leader. And we're going to get into that, I'm sure, in the next two. And that's going to be the same for us. But there's situations that we can always learn from and be better from and just grow out of. All right, now we're jumping to Dad's leader. Dad, I'll let you introduce him.
It was a fun exercise to think about who to choose to put on the show this morning. And the person I chose was the Right Honorable Sir Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill. How's that for a name?
Bless you.
To get that all on your to fit that all on your driver's license. Winston Churchill was the leader of Great Britain, primarily known through World War II, and really was, to me, one of the people I always look back on in history and admire for just what he did as a leader in such a difficult time. You know, the Nazi Germany, you know, invaded Poland in 1939, and then pretty quickly turned westward and invaded France and Belgium and the Low Countries. And where Churchill first stepped in was they had to evacuate soldiers, French soldiers, British soldiers from the mainland and get them back to Great Britain, and that was known as Dunkirk, and that's really where he first started. So I picked out three traits, Christian, that I think Churchill had as a great leader. And that first one was effective communication. He was really a great communicator. He could inspire people, kind of gather everybody together to fight together. And like one of the speeches that he gave that was really famous was as the soldiers were being evacuated from the mainland, he gave this "We'll fight on the beaches" speech. It wasn't a long speech, but part of it went like this: "We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." All of that speech in a moment when it looked very hopeless for Europe. And what a great communicator to rally everyone to the cause. And so he was just a really great communicator.
Obviously an important thing in leadership. He wouldn't have been able to win that war, win that situation by himself. If he'd have walked out there with his own weapon and just him, you know, he needed to be able to bring everybody else with him.
He was so effective at communication. That's why I read through that little part of the speech, because you hear that. And if you're that average British citizen and you see in the news, you know, that Nazi Germany is just overrunning everything, and you're wondering, well, Great Britain will just be next. And then you have Churchill as the leader of the country step in and say, nope, that's not how it's going to go. We're not going to let that happen. And that communication, you know, it was, you know, really direct. This is what we're going to do. And he got people to buy in. Another leadership trait that I admire Churchill for is something we talk about quite a bit with great leaders is resilience. You look at what happened. So after this evacuation at Dunkirk that happened in 1940, you start going further into World War II and in 1941, and Nazi Germany did turn their attention then on Great Britain. They had plans to invade Great Britain. It was difficult because you have to cross the English Channel, so it's not a land invasion. It's a little bit more difficult to do. And the Germans found it really difficult. And so they really switched tactics and basically decided to bomb Britain into submission. And so they started sending wave after wave every day of planes bombing London and other places in Great Britain. And it was called the Blitzkrieg. All those relentless attacks day in and day out would cause so many people to give up and to wave the white flag. And if you look at the prime ministers of Great Britain prior to Churchill, that's exactly what they did when they were dealing with Germany. Instead of standing up to Hitler, they tried to play good with him. And it seemed to work for a little while, but in the end, it was just what Germany wanted. Churchill was different. He was going to stand up and say, I don't care what happens, we're not going to wave the white flag to Germany. And he would, you know, he would go visit areas that were bombed to meet with the people, to give support to those the citizens that were in those bombings. You know, a little bit like Jordan, he was determined that Great Britain was going to survive this, regardless of how bad things looked. And so he was very resilient, didn't crumble in a situation that looked really dire.
Great communicator, extremely resilient. What's your third?
The third one is he was definitely a leader with vision. And, you know, the things that I just talked about, the evacuation at Dunkirk, the Blitzkrieg, you can just see how most leaders would see the doom and gloom. And he wasn't like that. He was a person that could see beyond that. He could see that if Germany could be defeated, there could be this new world and we could move forward. And it was really that thing that rallied the British people, but also, you know, the French resistance and the Americans came in to alongside, as well as, you know, Canadians and Australians and many others. But Churchill was just a pivotal person on pulling the Allies together to succeed. And one of the quotes I liked from Churchill about vision is, he said, a pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. And he just had this remarkable vision in the midst of all this really bad stuff to say, here's where we can end up.
I think the vision one is so fascinating. I mean, it kind of ties to your first communication piece where you've got a bunch of people that have basically no faith.
Yeah.
You know, that can't see that there's a way out.
Yeah.
And if you have one leader who's the ability to have faith that they can get out of whatever situation they're in, or that they're going to, if you're an organization, that you're going to grow, or, you know, just this, again, not unrealistic vision, but just this, just a passionate vision. Man, that's a person you want to rally around.
Yeah. So, Christian, those were three of the traits to me that really stand out about Churchill. You know, like any leader we talk about, Jordan, anybody else you want to bring up, all of us have our bad traits or things that aren't quite as good. You know, a couple of things where Churchill struggled. He was very stubborn and inflexible. So once, you know, once he made up his mind about doing something a certain way, even if it didn't turn out to be maybe the best way to do things, he was very stubborn about it and didn't want to change.
Are we related to him by chance?
Yeah, we probably are. And so many people are. We're stubborn. We think we're right. We think our ideas are the best, and we kind of get stuck on them. I think you kind of get blinded to seeing other perspectives. So that was one of the things where, you know, for all the great things that he had, probably an area he struggled with. And then the other one that I think is interesting is, you know, while he was an effective communicator and this visionary leader, I think he was also kind of gruff. You know, he was like he was an abrasive, sometimes difficult to work with person. He was like this great orator to the people, but if you had to go sit in a conference room with him to do things, he can be pretty abrasive and, you know, confrontational. And again, we're not going to offer up any of these people and say, oh, look at this is the perfect person, because he wasn't. But he was, Christian, in my mind, one of the greatest leaders we've ever seen in the world.
It's fun to hear stories of a guy who just everybody wants to take his lead and follow with what he's got going on, and just, you know, have somebody with almost such a conviction to be able to lead a group of people that has no faith or very little faith. And I think about Moses leading people out of Egypt.
Yeah.
And how time and time again, the people just wanted to go back to Egypt because it was where they were comfortable.
Yep.
And he had this God-given drive to make sure the Israelites didn't go back there. You know, Moses, like Churchill, just had such a vision, a hungry vision to make sure that what he believed was the right thing was going to happen. Man, another guy we could spend more time on, but let's go to our last one here. Big E, wrap us up with your leader you bring it to the table.
Sweet. You mentioning Moses makes me want to talk about Moses, but I chose King David, who was king of Israel from roughly, not 100% sure, but roughly the years 1010 BC to 970 BC. And he's an amazing character to study because of the dichotomy of his amazing leadership, seemingly, and his horrible leadership in other areas. I think he's most well known for his military and political leadership. At the time of his reign, he was anointed king over Israel when there was already a king in place. And he spent many, many years trying to serve the king of Israel, who is Saul, but fleeing from him because Saul was trying to kill him. So that was kind of the start of his journey of being a king, is actually fleeing from the king who's sitting on the throne at the moment, which had to have been extremely difficult to keep faith that he was actually going to be king. And for those who aren't familiar with the story, you have to go into 2 Samuel in the Bible and read it. When he took the throne, he spent lots and lots of years, basically his whole reign, expanding the kingdom and defeating other armies, other countries, other people groups to enlarge the nation of Israel. Now, the reason that I think that he was successful in his political and military leadership was because he sought the Lord. He was a shepherd boy who God chose to be king. And I don't think that the reason that he won battles was because of his amazing skill and being able to kill people, although he probably did develop an amazing skill. I think that what he did was that he sought the Lord, and God told him which battles that he had already won for him, and he went and fought those battles. Along the way, he made a ton of victories because God was the one fighting his battles. But there's a couple stories that I would like to talk about. He had these mighty men, and these were, I believe there was 37 of them, and that was like the large group. And then he had another like medium-sized group that was kind of his inner circle. And then he had three guys who were like his personal dudes that were like going to do everything for him.
Is that on their business card, personal dude?
Personal dudes. I don't know how to say it best, but like they were like they were his three of his right-hand men. His personal dudes. All right, this is a great story. So he's hiding in a cave from the Philistines, and he says, "Oh, that I would drink some water of Bethlehem." And that was like many, many miles away to get a drink of water. All right, they can't go down to the 7-Eleven. So these three dudes, his personal dudes, they go down to Bethlehem through like the armies of the Philistines, grab a bucket of water, come back, and they say, "Here, King David, we want to serve you and give you water as you asked for." And I was listening to some commentary on this, and you know how sometimes as leaders we process stuff out loud and we say stuff we really don't want other people to do, but then they take it literally and they go do it. Dad, you would say, you know, leaders, be careful what you ask for.
Yeah.
And in this situation, David, he asked for it, but whether or not he directly asked these guys to go do it or not, I don't think so. But when he got back, he didn't even drink the water. They had just risked their lives to get their king a bucket of water so he could have a drink. And he said, I will not drink the blood of these men who risked their lives so that I might have a drink. And he poured it out as a symbol of, as your leader, you are not here to serve me, but I'm here to serve you. And I'm not going to let you risk your life to fulfill my desires. That's one amazing story that we could talk a lot about. Another one that is, it's kind of mind-boggling to me, but he spent a lot of time in the region of Gath, which was interestingly enough, the place where Goliath was from. But when David was fleeing from Saul, and then later his son Absalom, I believe, he lived in this country of Gath. And some of the people there became loyal to him. They're called the Kerethites and the Pelethites. And so he had this foreign group of guys. These aren't his personal dudes. He had this foreign group of guys who were very loyal to him, who ended up becoming his main core of bodyguards, like the secret service to the king. They would go anywhere he would go. They would do anything that where he was, anything he would do, and they took care of him. Why would a group of people who are not part of his countrymen, not part of his family line, because here in this historical time period, we're talking like the family stuck together and they were a people group. What was his leadership ability, his qualities that made him a man that people wanted to follow, even though they could have been his enemies. And at one point they might have been. That's some of my riffs on David. I think he's an amazing guy to study. Curious what you guys have to say on all those comments.
On your first story, I mean, the term that you'd call it would be servant leadership, where, you know, just like the story said, and David did an act to actually show that he was serious about it, was that, yes, I'm the leader. And, you know, traditionally when we think kings and queens and that sort of a government structure, you have people actually bowing down to those leaders.
Right.
And David, you know, if you read the Bible at all, you know, he wasn't like that, but he instead, as the story shows, he was there to serve the people that were there to serve him. Mm. And in our day to day as leaders, it could be, instead of you having somebody go get you lunch, you know, hey, go run and go grab me lunch. Go get me a cup of coffee. You know, that's kind of your classic movie scene where the head honcho has the lowly intern go and get Starbucks for everybody, right?
Right.
Instead of doing that, what if the leader was the one who went and grabbed the coffee and said, you know what, intern, you're more important than me. I'm going to get something for you. I'm going to do something for you. How good would that make that intern feel? How important would it make him feel that, hey, this person that I'm supposed to be serving is serving me?
I think there's not a word for it, Christian, because it cannot be explained in earthly logic, right? It doesn't make sense as a leader to say, I'm going to serve someone else. That's not make sense to a earthly logic in the way I can say it. People in history that could be good leaders, right? Like the antagonists of the world, you know, you got like Hitler and Kim Jong-un, and power and control is their goal in leadership. Power and control. But what what you said earlier, Christian, about servant leader is that your goal should be to serve those who are there to serve you. And that truly is the story of successful leaders. And David is no different in that area. When he is serving people, things go extremely, extremely well. And when he chooses not to, there's other stories where he stays home from the battle. God called him into a lot of battles to go fight. His whole life was marked by war, defeating evil, basically just eradicating evil from the land. And that's what God had for him. And when he chose to stay home and send his guys out and not be there and not lead them on the front line, he fell into very, very bad sin. And a lot of mess came from when he chose to not lead his men in battle, which was what his calling was in life. Not solely, but clearly the story is written that he chose to stay home when he should have gone.
When you contrast servant leadership with, say, the opposite, where it's more this command and control leadership, think about the end game, because I think that's what you're really looking at is what do I want to get at the end of the day, at the end of the year? Here's what I want to get. I want to achieve these results. And I have these two leadership styles that I can choose from to get there. And you look at the command and control style, and it's that, you know, just kind of get this picture, like I'm going to stand behind you and whip you because this is where we're going and that's how we're going to get there. I'm going to make you go there. And you contrast that with the servant style. You're still attempting to go to the same place. But like you just said, you're there with the people, you're out in front of the people, you're supporting the people, you're still trying to go to the same place. You're still trying to achieve the same results, a different way to get there. I think the question for leaders is, what's the most effective way to do that?
Right.
And for so long and for so many leaders, the I'm going to drive you from behind command and control was the thought of that's the best way to get there. I'm just going to stay on the people and nip at their heels till we get there. And you find that probably isn't the most effective way because you create a lot of damage to the people along the way, even if you do ultimately get there.
Yeah.
Whereas the servant leader, you just have this picture, like you said, of the leader out front or the leader in the group with this mentality, like we're in this together. We're going to achieve this together. You still get to the same place. It's just how you get there.
I love that. It's a question of posture. Are you behind or are you in front? That's an amazing point. So I would like to answer that second question that I asked you guys. Are you familiar with the Kerethites and Pelethites?
Well, I haven't met them in person, but
you're funny, Pops. But are you familiar with like the story of them or I don't know a lot about them either, but these are foreign men in a time when people are very family and country dominated. And these two countries were at war. I mean, these people groups might not specifically been at war, but there's a lot of fighting going on here. And these men choose to be loyal to David. Why?
It's a good question, Big E. I think it sort of wraps up all three of our leaders here and other great leaders that we think about is their ability to rally others around them to accomplish a common goal. That was kind of what I was thinking about as we talked through each of those three leaders. But, it's not in how they go about rallying those people. The two words that I wrote down were they're contagious and infectious in this, in what they believe and what their purpose is, and it just permeates from them. And it's whether they're playing basketball or they're leading a country in defense against communism, or they're going out and their goal is to conquer more nations, whatever their whatever they're doing, the belief and the purpose behind what they're doing is so intense coming from that individual that it just pours out of them. It in everything they do, the things that they say, the things that they do, the actions they take, what they don't do, who they surround themselves with, all of these things, the way they go about what they're doing is so infectious that other people want to be a part of it. And so even if they are the enemy, so to speak, or if they're from a country that should have no business in communication or communion with this leader, that leader, again, just is you can't help but want to be a part of what they're doing. And of these three leaders, you know, I think that sums these guys up, is the people around them can't help but want to be a part of what their mission is. And because of that, a number of other things, but because of that, it has made them great leaders that we remember, that stories are written about, that will be talked about for all time, because other people wanted to be a part of what they believed. This might be my favorite podcast we've done. I really enjoyed it. And I'd be, listeners, if you've got other leaders that you think would be good to highlight on the show, we'd love to do that. So maybe we'll have to do another a part two of this great leader podcast here. Listeners, thanks as always for joining us here on the First Cup of Joe show. Challenge you to have such a strong belief in what you're doing that other people can't help but want to follow your lead. And as always, keep your mornings early, your coffee cup full, and keep leveling up.